You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by the team at Food Matters. Hello. In these podcasts, we explore a huge range of crucial issues and exciting developments in the food industry with brilliant guests drawn from all areas of expertise. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a TV presenter and writer, and I specialize in food and science. In today's podcast, we're joined by Danielle Nierenberg, president of Food Tank, the think tank for food, and a globally recognized expert on sustainable agriculture and food issues. Now, Danielle recently received the Julia Child Award, which celebrates leaders who've made an impact on the world through food. We'll be taking a look at some of the shared global food challenges we're facing in 2021, the impact of global 19 on a food system, and drawing on the experience of travels to look at environmentally sustainable ways of alleviating hunger and poverty. Danielle, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, well, we're delighted you can join in. Now, we're recording this just hours away from hearing whether or not the Democrats have effectively taken control of the Senate as well as Congress. So I hope you'll allow me later on to ask you a few questions relating to the potential for change that we might see. Are you all waiting on tenterhooks there?
I'm on pins and needles.
Okay, well, let's just roll back a little bit. So for the listeners who aren't familiar with you and aren't familiar with your work, it'd be great if you could tell us about the Food Tank's mission and your role in it.
Absolutely. So I'm president and co-founder of Food Tank. My other co-founder is Bernard Pollack. And, you know, we started Food Tank with this a very simple idea of highlighting stories of hope and success in the food system, both domestically here in the United States and globally. And we decided to do that because, you know, I worked for many years at an environmental organization where I eventually headed our food and agriculture work. And like many environmental organizations at that time, it was really focused on the problems, on kind of the gloom and the doom. And what I was seeing traveling now to 70 plus countries across the globe, but at that time about, you know, I was doing a lot of research in sub-Saharan Africa. I traveled to half the continent. What I was seeing is a lot of potential, a lot of great projects that if they had a little bit more investment behind them, a little bit more research, and a little bit more attention, that they could be scaled up and out and replicated in different ways. And what we decided to do is sort of switch the paradigm and tell those stories, you know, of hope and really work to inspire others. You know, our audience is pretty wide. It's, you know, everyone's from dads and moms to chefs and culinary professionals to farmers and fields and scientists and policymakers. And so we really try to, you know, again, create an opportunity for them to be inspired and know that there is hope out there for our food and agriculture systems, despite the challenges, whether it's COVID-19 or climate change or any of the other problems that exist.
Now, this involves a quantum leap in our understanding of the realities on the ground in certain countries. Like when I did my first documentary series where I visited a refugee camp, I was really taken aback. I had thought I was going out there doing a story about miserable people, people crying, people in need, people not having the ability to go beyond their closest problems and their wants. And what I found was a vibrant culture with people with communications networks, families having a wild time and enjoying each other, an integrated community. And I had to think, I had to rethink my entire approach to what I was going to do with this documentary, because it's not about a pile of people, you know, chasing after a bag of rice. It's about different types of problems and more complex problems. Is this what you found? That in actual fact, when you visit the places where there are problems to be solved, it's much more complicated than we ever thought we'd see from afar?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, what you're describing is what most people think about the Global South. They think it's a place where people are, you know, squabbling over a bag of rice, or, you know, there's such poverty and conflict that nothing can get done. But, you know, just like, you know, we are resilient people in the global north, the global south has, you know, a lot of innovation, a lot of entrepreneurship, a lot of again, hope. And so, it shouldn't be startling to folks, but I guess it is, that, you know, people are resilient, that they're innovative, that they're smart, no matter where they live.
They're excited. And there's, I mean, just one aspect of it that from what I discovered was that everyone everywhere brews beer, pretty much. You know, even in refugee camps, they'll take anywhere you go, people are doing this. And it's not just because everyone wants to get drunk. It's part of the economy. It's a way of making a buck. It's value added to the grain that you're given.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the thing. People are find the joy where they can, right? And that's just one way. But I've seen that, and you know, every village I've ever visited has its own brand of you know, spirits or alcohol or beer. So yeah, I think people find ways to be innovative to celebrate and enjoy their lives.
Yeah, and so I'm very interested in this, that it's a message of positivity that you have here rather than everything else. Now, in terms of the different challenges that people face, can you give us a bit of an overview of the change, how it varies from region to region? Whereas one problem might be endemic in one area, whereas something completely different might be the problem in another.
You know, it's hard to say. I think one thing that sort of holds true, whether we're talking about the global south or the global north, is the sort of unrecognized value of women in the food system. Women make up around 43% of the agricultural labor force globally. In some countries, they make up around 80% of all farmers. Yet they don't get the same sort of respect that male farmers do. They don't certainly don't get access to credit and financial services. They don't get the same kinds of education. And I think that's a huge problem. You know, the United Nations has found that if women had the same access to resources as men, they could raise yields by anywhere from 20 to 30% and lift as many as 150 million people out of hunger. And so I think we're doing a disservice. We're really putting ourselves at peril. In peril, again, whether we live in the global south or the global north, if we don't recognize the role that women play in the food system.
And they seem to suffer an enormously as well. Certainly the, you know, in terms of cooking, it's always the women have to cook. It's often in making food over fires inside in huts, and where, you know, terrible problems with breathing and diseases, they affect women so much more than they affect men. But also, I think what's interesting for me about Food Tank is this blend. There are articles on your site about farmers' right to repair their own equipment, and that's all about farmers in Nebraska. And then you're looking at global issues in Africa, which is about empowering women. Is this a difficult spread to be able to handle? You know, from domestic issues to global poverty?
No, I mean, I think it's what we have to do. We have to bridge these issues. We have to show that, you know, whether you're talking about the right to repair movement in the Midwestern United States or the role of women farmers all over the globe, these are issues that are interconnected. These are issues that everyone should know about. And you know, I think people need, our readers, what we want them to understand is the resiliency that these folks have, that there are movements going on, that there are actual problems being solved and incredible things happening. So I think it's, you know, our responsibility as an organization and my responsibility personally is to be able to share those stories to as wide an audience as possible.
And Food Tank is actually a relatively large organization, isn't it? How do you, as a team, learn about new ideas? And then what are your most successful means of spreading your knowledge?
Yeah, just to be clear, we're a very small organization with a very big voice. There are only three of us who are really full-time. We have a cadre of volunteers and fellows and contributors from around the globe. But, you know, the way we operate is, you know, we try to use our network. You know, we have this very robust network of people who receive our newsletter, you know, about 300,000 across the globe. They're good at feeding us stories or feeding us ideas for things. You know, and again, they range from farmers to policymakers to moms and dads. And I think, you know, being able to utilize that network and make people feel part of a platform and a community is kind of one of the things that we really enjoy doing and one of the things we do best.
And I'd love to get into a few specifics, if you don't mind. So what are, I know that you cover a vast, vast range of different subjects. What are the ones that stand out for you as the most interesting with the most innovative solutions? So, you know, we've talked on this program about things like local small scale power grids in rural Africa. We've talked about the problems with aid. We've talked about, you know, better designed electric stoves and insect protein. Can you just pick out a couple of problems that you think are interesting that have had interesting solutions?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think there's one thing that has always interested me is the way farmers are preserving indigenous or traditional crops. These are crops that have often, you know, they've been called orphan crops or forgotten foods, or often they're thought of as poor people's foods. That's what you eat if you don't have anything else. And I think
any examples of that? I mean, we're talking about things like teff and
absolutely teff, millets, sorghums. You know, millets and sorghums are often thought of as bird seed in Western Africa, but they're very resilient crops. They're very delicious if cooked well. And so I think, you know, restoring that respect and that interest in indigenous foods. One organization that does that really well is ICRISAT. It's the International Center for Research in the Semi-Arid Tropics. They have what they call a smart food program to really reinvigorate interest in millets and sorghums. And you know, they have cooking contests. They have chefs who are using these products, and doing shows on the radio or television, and really just sort of restoring, you know, the cultural respect that people had for these crops. Well, you know, the things that people's grandparents grew that fell out of favor because of an interest in, you know, more exotic foods or imported foods. And I think that's one problem that, you know, I've seen a lot of growth in over the last decade or so. This, you know, real interest in not just preserving these crops, but making sure that farmers can make money off of them. But there is a way to develop fair trade practices so that you and I can eat interesting crops like, fonio or again, millets and sorghums in the United States or in Europe, and also help farmers in other parts of the world. So I think that's one thing that has really interested me, because those are the crops of the future. They're the crops of the past for sure. But as we face the growing impacts of climate change, these are crops that, you know, can withstand pests and disease. They can withstand high temperatures or flooding in some cases. And so these are really crops that we need to look to for the future. And that's really interesting to me.
And the way that I've seen these crops kind of suffer is often because of badly targeted aid, where a crop that is not necessarily indigenous has been landed on a community. It's been either given for free or sold very cheaply, and it's forced out the indigenous local crops. Does that still seem to be the case? Is aid still handled badly, do you think?
I mean, in some cases, it certainly is, but I've seen real progress, especially, again, over the last 5 years. Agencies like the World Food Program have made huge efforts. They won the Nobel Prize this year, but they've made huge efforts to start procuring food locally and regionally, so for aid, so that, you know, you're not importing food from the United States, from farmers in the United States. You're actually using the food that's already available in certain regions to feed, communities in crisis. And I think that's a real advance. It seems, you know, it seems like common sense, right? But I think, you know, the way, especially our subsidy system in the United States works, farmers overproduce crops and then those outlets were available to them for aid. That has, as you said, really disrupted local economies. And I think we're working very hard to change that. But it takes time, and it takes, you know, entrepreneurship from farmers in those regions of, you know, sub-Saharan Africa or India or other parts of the global south to really be able to meet that demand and make sure that people are fed.
Now, you've traveled just ridiculously extensively in sub-Saharan Africa. What are the issues that you've seen that are low-hanging fruit, the kinds of things where you go, well, there's a really simple solution to this if only ... You know, what are the things that really stand out that could be solved most immediately?
I think one of the biggest issues is post-harvest losses. Farmers don't always have adequate storage facilities for their crops, or they don't know how to store particular things properly. But there are very simple solutions to preventing post-harvest losses that, you know, a lot of farmers just don't know about, or a lot of extension workers just don't know about. You know, cutting the tops off sweet potatoes, for example, before they're stored can, you know, improve their storage capacity, you know, up to 90%. It's, you know, they're just little things, you know, making sure that there's better infrastructure. This is not necessarily low hanging fruit, but you know, roads in Africa, as you well know, are often, you know, very difficult to travel on in a short amount of time, and farmers are often, you know, lose crops before they can get them to market. I think if countries could invest in better infrastructure, you know, like roads, then a lot of this would be solved. And, you know, that's not necessarily an easy thing to do, but it is kind of a simple solution in terms of this would, you know, be a big investment that would have a huge payoff down the line.
It's also that these issues are relatively unsexy, aren't they? Transport, infrastructure, land ownership, you know, documentation, things like that. They don't. That's not going to drum up, you know, the dollar in somebody's pocket to be dropped towards a cause. But often these are the fundamentals that allow innovation and allow entrepreneurship to work on top of it. Do you think that's an issue that needs to be thought of differently? Certainly with the new administration coming into the U.S.
Sure. I mean, I think these issues, while they might not be sexy, they're more important than ever before because COVID-19 has exposed all these cracks and fissures that, you know, we knew existed, those of us who studied these issues, but now they become apparent to everyone, right? Consumers for the first time in, you know, London, where you all are, or here in the United States, saw empty grocery store shelves for the first time probably in our lives. You know, at the beginning of the pandemic, we've seen shortages of foods, you know, throughout the last 11 or 12 months. And so I think people have a better understanding. They know the importance of our food system in a way that they didn't know this time last year, probably. And I think that's very important. So that's how you make these issues sexy, when they hit people who aren't in the global South. We finally stand up and pay attention because, oh, you know, we can't get the food that we want. And you know, I think that's been a huge change.
Suddenly we understand what the problem was. And what do you think is critical to the success of scaling up of innovations? Is it about investment? And is that investment locally in projects or globally? Is it aid? How can we best support innovation in developing countries?
Yeah, I don't know if I like to use the term scaling up so much as scaling out. I think when we look at scale, we often think, oh, it has to grow big, big, big. And often these projects and these innovations have to spread sort of horizontally. They have to be replicated. They have to be sort of revised and used in different ways because every community is so different. But it does require investment. And I mean, I think that's what it has been lacking by governments, whether it's governments in the United States or governments in sub-Saharan Africa. And that requires political will. It requires understanding that small and medium scale farmers are at the forefront of our food system. It's not the large farms that produce commodity crops that we've had to depend on, especially now during the pandemic. It's really those small scale and medium scale farmers who are actually nourishing people. There's been such a investment in starchy staple crops and commodity crops. And now I think we're seeing a real turn that, you know, whether it's health professionals or policymakers or scientists, they understand the need for, you know, looking at food for health, food as medicine. And that to do that, we need to be growing and diversifying our cropping systems and focusing on nutritious grains, on fruits and vegetables, and things that will actually secure our personal health and our immunity.
That sounds absolutely spot on from everything that I've heard as well. Now, 2020, difficult year, COVID-19, we've talked about it far, probably not enough, but far too much for most people's liking. Now, I think that most countries have become, selfish is not quite the right word, but nationalistic and introspective about COVID. We're concerned with our own countries. To be honest, we're concerned with our own families. Are we going to have enough food in our cupboard and fridge? We know very little, I think, about the impacts on the developing world. Can you fill us in a little bit more on what's changed for the developing world because of COVID-19?
Yeah, I mean, one thing is that concerns me is that there's, you know, research had to stop research on, better fertilizer usage, but, in better crop storage, better, equality in the food system. The research from research institutions that are part of the Consultative Group on International Research, Agricultural Research, research from universities across the world, whether it's in the United States or in sub-Saharan Africa or elsewhere, research has had to stop because of safety concerns. And I feel like that's going to be a real setback in the decades to come. We're losing a lot of really important research and data collection that was being done. The other thing that I think is important to mention is that we really don't know the impacts of COVID-19 in many countries because there's not great data on who has been tested, who has the disease, number of deaths, those kinds of things. So I think that's another setback. And I think, we're losing a lot of the progress that we've made on a number of issues. I mentioned the role of women before. Women and often suffer the brunt of any disaster, natural or otherwise. They're the ones who, eat least and last, along with girls. Girls are not in school. So we're losing a lot of the progress that was made on women's equality. And I think that's, we're going to see the impacts of that for years to come.
Yeah. Now, obviously, thinking back to your message of positivity, are there any actual benefits that have come on board from COVID-19? Or is it, again, just too early to say because we don't have the data?
No, I think there's lots of things that we can take away. I mentioned food as medicine before. You're seeing way more interest in that. There hasn't, ironically, been a lot of investment from either national research institutions or governments into nutrition. And I think now that there's a real focus because we understand that food is really our first line of defense. The people who suffer most and worst from COVID are those who, are either suffer from overweight or obesity, who have diabetes or hypertension. These are all, in many cases, diet-related diseases. So I think there's a real focus on investing in food for health that I haven't seen before. I think, one of the positives is that there's an interest in restoring regional food systems. And, there are always going to have to be, in my opinion, large food systems global food systems, but I think there's a more of an interest in making sure that different communities, different regions have their own mill, that they have their own processing plant for animals. Mm. We saw huge closures here in the United States because of COVID-19, and animals were euthanized or because they couldn't be processed. And so I think if you have more of this regional infrastructure, that we will be more resilient the next time another global shock hits, whether it's a pandemic or something that happens from climate change. This is not the only global shock that's going to hit the world, and we need to be prepared.
Now, I mean, the weaknesses that have been exposed in the UK have been interesting. So, we were looking at a huge amount at the resilience of the supply chain, the food supply chain in the UK. Things have been surprisingly resilient in the UK, and we've had difficulties, and we've had runs on some foods. I wonder what's the experience in the US? What have been the main? You mentioned that some things weren't available. What's been the main impact from COVID-19 over there?
I think the main impact, the thing that's most important for me, is that who we call essential workers, whether it's your grocery store cashier or farm workers who are harvesting crops, or the truck drivers who are taking food to grocery stores, that they have had incredible suffering take place over the last several months. And at first they were given hazard pay that has disappeared in many cases. I think that's been a real wake-up call for many Americans, that they realize for the first time how important they're, those folks on the front lines of the food system are, and that they realize that they're out there. I didn't think Americans understood how important truck drivers were and how, vulnerable they are to the risks of COVID. And so I think that's, in one way, it's a huge negative, but it's also a huge positive because, again,
yes, absolutely. I think we've had the same here, that the concept here is we call them key workers, and the fact that key workers are a broad spread. It's not just police, ambulance, fire service. It's a whole range of people that are essential to keeping us going. Now, you also have a very grassroots approach in the States. You're very close to farmers and their challenges. What about things for farmers? What are some of the best initiatives you've seen over the last year?
I mean, farmers have really had to pivot. And again, this is small and medium-sized farmers who lost a lot of outlets for their food. Restaurant closures really affected farmers. They had to pivot to either, you know, providing food for schools, for school systems that were distributing food to students and their families and communities. They had to, you know, donate a lot of food. They had to learn marketing skills that they probably never had to learn before if they were selling out. Yeah. To consumers and through CSA or subscription boxes. They faced a lot of challenges, but I feel like they've been so resilient. I don't know how long they'll be able to keep this up. This has been a tough slog for farmers. With an administration, the Trump administration has not invested a lot in small and medium scale farmers in this country. And so I'm hoping, you know, with the new administration that we can have, some of the support and investment that those farmers need, whether it's, you know, helping them gain new skill sets or, being able to help them find new markets. I think there a lot needs to be done.
Now, this is an interesting area, isn't it? Because there's been a lot of controversy, really, in many countries about community food support projects. Do you think they've been very important in the US, and have they filled a gap that just simply would not otherwise have been filled?
Absolutely. Absolutely. If to get fresh, you know, produce, and I live in Baltimore, Maryland, right? If farmers and CSA projects had not stepped up to the plate to fill that void, there would have been many months where I think a lot of folks wouldn't have gotten access to really, you know, healthy, fresh food. Not completely. Grocery stores still had food coming from California, but, you know, it wasn't of high quality. It wasn't easy to access. It wasn't affordable. And I think a lot of the local farms here in the region, in Maryland and Virginia, have really been able to step up to the plate and fill that void that otherwise wouldn't have been filled.
Which really brings us on to administrative change in the US. So we've seen Biden voted in. We're about to find out whether or not the Democrats are going to take control of Congress. Can you foresee change on either scenario? And is US food policy likely to move forwards? And if so, in what way?
I mean, I'm hopeful, right? We have a new Secretary of Agriculture who's also an old Secretary of Agriculture, Secretary Thomas Vilsack. And he, I think because of the decimation that happened to so many U.S. agencies, including USDA, but also EPA, Health and Human Services, and others, you need people who can come in and rebuild immediately. And why I may not agree with all of former Secretary Vilsack's viewpoints on many things. I've met him many times. He's very experienced in government. I think he has a lot of ability to rebuild and get this agency back on track. This is an agency that has not done well over the last 4 years and has not done much that hasn't been destructive. And so I think rebuilding, USDA is one of the things that I'm most concerned about, and getting the right people in and addressing a lot of the injustices that have happened over, you know, many, many decades with, you know, racism towards Black farmers, lack of investment in Black farmers in this country. So there's a lot that needs to be done. I am hopeful, but you mentioned our Senate race here in Georgia. If we get Democratic control of Congress, I think that President Biden and Vice President Harris have a lot more leeway to make sure that some of the promises that they've made around food and agriculture. Vice President-elect Harris has been very interested in the plight of farm workers and securing, you know, better pay for them. I hope those things will actually be able to have a national stage and that we can make real progress on them.
And we're obviously delving into a very difficult area for somebody like you to make a comment. So I appreciate you giving us your statements on that. Now, do you foresee that there needs to be a focus on sustainability, on reducing food poverty, or is it an integrated approach to solving lots of different problems that is going to have the greatest effect in the USA?
I mean, I think it has to be holistic because, you know, agriculture is one of the biggest contributors to climate change, but it also can be one of the biggest forces for reversing or mitigating climate change. And I think if we're going to look at, you know, all of the problems that the United States is facing right now, it has to, you know, be an integrated approach. We have a lot to do over the next, you know, not just 4 years, but over the next decade to make sure that, you know, we are meeting the sustainable development goals, that we are you know, trying to find ways to mitigate climate change and make sure that, you know, future generations have the access to the same kinds of opportunities that we do now. So a lot needs to be done. Whoever is president, what has happened over these last 4 years has just been chaos. And I know, you know, you've experienced some of these things with your own leaders.
Yes.
But this has been an extraordinary and extraordinarily difficult time for anything to get done that could be positive. So I am hopeful that with a new administration, that more hopeful things can come about.
Yeah. Now, 2020 was obviously difficult for travel, for research, and all sorts of things, presumably for you and for Food Tank. What have you set any specific goals for 2021?
Absolutely. And how we handled last year was, you know, I went from traveling about 200 days a year to different conferences and, you know, talking to farmers in different places to really going online and doing all of our sort of research, if you will, online. We, from March through the end of the year, we interviewed about 250 food experts from around the globe, everyone from the chief economist at the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization to women farmers in Kenya. And so really, you know, collecting their thoughts and their goals about how the food system needs to be reset. And we're working on a book called Resetting the Food System in advance of the UN Food System Summit that happens in September to really help provide a roadmap for what the food system can look like and to share those learnings from those experts. You know, these are not my own thoughts. These are what we've seen and heard over the last 11 months and how folks have coped in different ways and made progress in different ways. Post-COVID, we're looking at a 50-state tour of the United States to really celebrate the good food movement and how, you know, farmers and researchers and you know, communities have really been able to withstand the enormous pressures from COVID-19 and an administration that really wasn't invested in them. So that 50-state tour will take place over 3 years. And, you know, it will happen hopefully in the fall when we can all gather safely again after being vaccinated and folks wear their masks, we'll get out of this much sooner. But I think being able to celebrate what has happened and provide a platform for those voices who have been doing good work, just, you know, with their heads down in their own communities to improve food systems during this really difficult time, I'm really excited about learning from them.
So I've got one last question for you, and that is, we've talked a lot about the problems that people face, endemic issues, systemic problems that need broad solutions. What about consumers? What about you and me and our friends and our families? Is there any one action that you would like to see individuals make to what they do to help make a significant contribution to a sustainable food system?
Yeah, I mean, really assess what you're buying and what you're throwing away. Food waste is a huge issue in both the United States and in the UK. If consumers could curb their food waste, and I've seen a lot of progress and heard from a lot of different experts that COVID-19 has really made people reassess how much food they waste because they're actually cooking it more in their kitchens. I think that's the greatest thing that we as consumers can do is really, you know, look at our own food waste and prevent it.
Well, Danielle, thank you so much for that. And thank you so much for joining us today. It's been absolutely fascinating.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to the Tabletop Podcast brought to you by Food Matters, and you heard from Danielle Nierenberg and me, Stefan Gates. Thank you very much. If you enjoyed this episode, you might like one of our other podcasts in which we explore pretty much every aspect of the food industry, from how the UAE can achieve food security to the rise of robots in farming. Subscribe to get every episode freshly delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, take a look at foodmatters.co.uk. Goodbye. You've been listening to the Tabletop Podcast, brought to you by Food Matters. Subscribe to get every episode freshly delivered on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, please visit foodmatters.co.uk.